I'm flipping through greeting cards from a new Hallmark collection called 8 Bamboo. It's a line of cards honoring Chinese American heritage by celebrating occasions specific to Chinese culture, but the one that catches my attention is doing something much simpler and much subtler than that. It's a card meant for new parents welcoming a new baby, and it's a lot like other cards already available for that purpose, but on the card, the baby that you see doesn't have a rosy complexion or golden tufts of hair like you would typically see on cards like these. This baby's got a shock of black hair, and it's clear from just a few minor details that the baby is of Asian descent. In other words, this baby looks like the actual child the recipient of the card is probably expecting to greet any day now. It's such a small thing and such a huge thing all at once. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking about four new multicultural card lines from Hallmark, one Chinese, one Indian, one African-American, and one Latino. I've got two of the card creators here in the studio with me now. Monique Haupt is a product director at Hallmark, and she focuses specifically on cultural identity. Hi, Monique.
Hello.
What inspired these four card collections? What's the story there?
It's actually a pretty fascinating story. So as you probably know, Hallmark is about helping people share what's in their hearts. We're about connecting and helping people with their relationships. And part of our mission is around reflecting people's real lives and making sure that we enrich those relationships and we have a product available for all people. So diversity and inclusion is important not only in the walls of Hallmark, but it's also important in the products and services that we deliver. So the background on these on this product was really around a need to go after multiple different things. So one being younger consumers, and so trying to make sure that we have product that's reflective of their lives and that can enrich their relationships, and also having product that is relevant to emerging consumer groups. And so, for instance, you mentioned the card in 8 Bamboo. And so we knew that this was the fastest growing segment of the population, the Asian population. And so we created card lines for Chinese Americans, like you said, and Indian Americans. That way we could reflect what was important in their lives and those specific occasions that would be meaningful to them.
So you're basically, on some level, the person who kind of makes some calls about whether a particular occasion or sentiment merits a greeting card. Is that right?
That's correct.
That is so cool, first of all.
Thank you.
But also, how does that process work?
So internally, we would look at consumer trends, consumer demographics, purchasing behavior, and other research data. We talk to consumers. I work with my creative partner who's here today, Christy, and we a lot of times come up with concepts that we can show consumers. But the process really is kind of end to end. It starts off with, do we have a need? Are there unsatisfied greeting needs out there that we could create product for? We make sure we have the right price. We make sure it's in the right place. We make sure the product, the actual items are going to meet their needs. And then we work with our retailers to get them on board, which they are generally very supportive because they see the need as well. It's their customers coming in their stores that are going to purchase it. And so it's a full end-to-end process that my team is very happy and excited to be a part of.
So were these new card collections created more on a principle, like the idea of representation, or was there a sense of external demand? Were people asking for these cards?
It's a little bit of both. But it's mostly around we saw a gap in our portfolio, right? So as we're looking at the demographics and we're saying, and it's four different lines. So each one of them has a different story. So as you think about 8 Bamboo and Golden Thread, we looked and said fastest growing population. There are specific occasions like the...
There's a Diwali car in Golden Thread.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or Eid or the baby car that you mentioned. And so those are specific needs that... There are other cards that would be okay for, but we love it when our consumers say they found the perfect card. And so felt like there was an opportunity to launch two brands, very targeted at each one of those different consumers. For Uplifted and Love You Mucho, both of those started in a slightly different fashion, is what I referenced earlier, and wanting to go after kind of that younger consumer. And so making sure we had product.
So Uplifted is...
Uplifted is a collection that we created that is about empowerment and affirmation, which is extremely important in the African-American community these days. It's about sisterhood. It was really created as a woman-to-woman sending collection.
So it's as specific as African-American women.
Well, that's our design target, right? But as we know, mahogany, very specifically, we've heard over the years, anytime I'm out in public and I'm showing product or I'm talking about the brand, people tell me all the time, I'm not black and I buy it and I love it. Or I just got a card from Mother's Day and I flipped it over and it was mahogany. So although that's our design target, a lot of the sentiment and a lot of the visuals on the card don't necessarily alienate anyone from buying it, right? And this country is becoming more multicultural and more multiracial. So even if I'm not, you may be, and I may be buying it for you. You may be my friend, you may be my sister-in-law, you may be my niece, right? And so whether you are African-American or not, you may or may not have a need for it. And we are finding more and more that people have that need, but that is our design target.
Well, I want to bring Christy Moreno in on this. Christy is an editorial director for Hallmark. She's the creative partner that Monique referenced earlier. And she's been working on these new cards, too. Hi, Christy.
Hi.
What exactly is your role in developing these card lines?
Well, I'm an editorial director, but editorial directors at Hallmark have a lot of things we do. And one of my favorite responsibilities is that I'm a consumer advocate, right? I don't just look at, oh, this message would be great on this card because, you know, it looks great and it has the same tone and the vibe. It really is looking at how would this message satisfy not just one need, right? But
yeah, you need more than one customer.
Yes, yes. And just listening to what Monique is saying, really what we're doing is that with all of these four collections in particular is that we are creating product that is, as you said, not alienating, but that really halos out to intercultural relationships as well, right? We know that, and in particular, younger consumers, definitely Generation C is expecting every brand to really represent what their relationships are like. When I look at what I do as far as a consumer advocacy goes, and it's not just me, I have a wonderful team of very talented, creative people, and it's a very collaborative process where we look at, through research, what are the relationships like, right? I can tell you, for example, that a fifth of Latina women are marrying outside their ethnicity and outside their race. So what does that mean to family dynamics? What does that mean to how we are raising our children now? What are the values that we're instilling in them? What are the traditions that people are celebrating or incorporating into their lives?
Can I just jump in and ask you how you... Can you tell me the story of a specific card in the Love You Mucho line where you had to think about all of that to make that greeting card?
Yes, I have a card right here. So Love You Mucho is really looking at what the Latinx trends are. We did a lot of social listening, which is looking at what are people sharing online, right? We know that a lot of relationships are now establishing communications and in the digital space, social media. So what are people proud to share? What are they commenting on? What are the hashtags that they're sharing? And what are the topics that are very relevant to them that they're actually wanting to share and replicate? And a lot of that it really is based around women empowerment. I don't know if you're familiar with Mexican lucha libre, but this card actually has a Mexican wrestling mask, and it's pretty striking design.
Yeah, it's purple and sparkly.
Purple and sparkly, and just, you know, very, very
against the turquoise background.
Just very striking. But this card really is based around the concept of, you know, you're a fighter, you're strong, you're empowered, you're resilient. But it's married with this concept of it's a fun luchador mask. But then again, the message is really, you know, sharing, hey, I'm here for you.
And I've also noticed that the words on the card are about two words in English and one in Spanish.
Yes. So Love You Mucho is our main target, as Monique was sharing, is that we're looking at what were the gaps, what are the opportunities to grow our product offering. What we're seeing with young Latinos that are culturally fluid, that are English dominant, but that yet grew up either in a bilingual household or that they're retroculturating. We're living in an era where identity and cultural identity is very important. People are developing this stronger than ever. They want to know and they want to share what they stand for. And so within the Latinx demographics, we're looking at people are tracing back their heritage, their roots, and saying, this is what I want to latch on to.
Can you tell me about your own background and cultural heritage?
Oh, yes. I am a proud Mexican-American. So I grew up in a bilingual and bicultural household. I was actually born in the United States, but raised in Mexico City, Mexico. And then I came back to the States for college, and I've been here since.
What? I wonder how you experience the cards in Hallmark's Love You Mucho collection as a potential consumer or recipient of one of the cards.
I love them. They're my babies. it is very interesting because Hallmark has had Spanish language cards for 3 decades. And that is certainly a very substantial part of our portfolio within cultural identity. But we really had this gap, right, in creating product that was representative of second, third generation
And just
Latinx.
A younger sensibility.
And a very younger sensibility, right? And so my relationship with Love You Mucho is really that, you know, there's a concept, there is an idea, there is a reason behind every single card. I work with a team of amazing designers and illustrators and writers and editors. This is certainly a big team effort, right? And we're very proud to see cards represent who we are as a team as well. Our team is very diverse. We have, as part of our creative team and cultural identity, we have people who self-identify as Afro-Latino, LGBTQ, bicultural. Help me out, Monique. I mean, there's just, you know, we have some Asian designers and illustrators as well. So there's a lot of sense of pride within our team in creating cards like this.
Monique, how do you relate personally to the cards in these collections? I understand that you actually received one.
I did. It's one of my favorites, and I have it here. So it is on a black background with white lettering on it that says, "You are a Black history fact in the making." And on the inside, it says, "You're on the come up and making sure others are coming up with you. That's power. That's grace. That's love. That's you." And it actually comes with this pretty phenomenal envelope that is designed on the inside. And on the outside of it, it says, "Hella inspired." So I received this card just a couple of months ago. And obviously, like we've talked about, I was a part of the team and we buy
each other. Familiar with the card.
I had seen the card once or twice or 100 times before. And we buy cards for each other within Hallmark for our birthdays and our work anniversaries. But I had recently received 2 awards, both pretty much centered around my passion for diversity and inclusion and for making sure people feel included within the walls of Hallmark. And so someone gave me this card to celebrate that award. And I was like, I read it and I was like, I'm a Black history fact in the making. Like, I didn't think of myself that way.
Yeah, you thought of other people who would receive
this
card.
Right, I'm like, that's Martin Luther King. That's not Monique Haupt. But then as I really got to thinking about it, one of the awards I received was the first ever Champion of Inclusion Award at Hallmark. And I'm like, I might actually be a Black history fact in the making. And it was pretty special because the person who gave it to me is a younger Hallmarker, younger in age and younger in number of years at Hallmark. And for her to view me that way, it wasn't about whether I saw myself as a Black history fact in the making. It was the fact that she saw me that way, that it was pretty special for me to receive this card. So as much as I look at a lot of the cards that we make and I'm like, I would buy that and I would buy that, I actually can't physically buy them all. and so when I actually receive one, I'm like, that was pretty special.
It also, it's pretty amazing that a card that you had helped to craft, that you felt differently about it when you received it.
Absolutely.
And you felt differently about yourself.
It became very personal at that point. Right. It gave me a sense of pride, but it also was very humbling because I'm like, people are watching me.
I do not want to offend any Hallmark employees when I say this. I think a great card is a really special thing, and I so appreciate what you do. Greeting card messages can be cheesy, and I get it, because the card's got to speak to a lot of people's experiences. Mm-hmm. So, like, you as the card writer can't share a sentiment that's only mine and my mom's on Mother's Day, because you need more than 2 people. To buy your cards. But when you try to create a message that is both casting a wide net and also speaks to someone's really personal experience with race and culture mm-hmm. and relationships, do you risk falling into a stereotyping trap? Is it hard to walk that line between acknowledging and pandering?
Well, this is, I'm very happy that you're asking that question because we take this very seriously, right? We have research really is our anchor. And we as a creative team, and I will answer that question because really it's in my realm. There are three buckets, I would say, or three sources that we really pay attention to. One is our internal team, right? I was sharing with you that within our team, not only do we have talent, but we have representation. And with representation, we're making sure that we have different lifestyles, different walks of life, different experiences, different generations. And so we really share and collaborate, and we share the needs. The second one is we have wonderful employee resource groups at Hallmark. Now, employee resource groups are conformed of all people or members of different areas and disciplines at Hallmark that self-identify or are allies of these groups. For example, we have a Latino group, we have an LGBTQ group, we have an African-American group.
And the people can come from within your own team or elsewhere on the Hallmark staff.
Yes, so they can be coming from, finance, or they can be coming from procurement or whatever other area. And they bring not only richness in perspective, but they're also seen as representing the market segments, right? And the third one is we take research seriously. So we talk to our consumers. We do focus groups. We show them what we're thinking. We share concepts, but we also take feedback seriously, right? So we make sure that in different levels and different stages, we are tapping to the wonderful resources that we have to validate what we're putting out the market.
So are you guys thinking about adding to these collections with cards tailored to other cultures and backgrounds? Are there more on the horizon?
We are always keeping our eye on the market, on the consumer evolving consumer base. And so I can't speak to anything that's on the horizon right now, but just know that we will always keep our eye on that. And if there's an opportunity to present itself, we would definitely tap into that.
So just thinking about the consumer experience, as I mentioned, I've read some really favorable reviews of these card lines. Mm-hmm. There are people who are really excited about these mm-hmm. cards and feel validated by them. And not just validated, but included in sort of a shared cultural experience.
They feel seen.
Get a greeting card where they don't have to sort of stretch to imagine it applying to them. What are some of your favorite responses? Have you heard about someone reacting to a card in a really profound way?
I want to share the 8 Bamboo Boba Tea card. And I don't know if you've seen it, Gina, but actually Kansas City hosted a few weeks ago the National Association for Asian American Professionals Convention. And we were there not only as attendees, but we were there showcasing our product and really, reading the pulse. What are people reacting? We were sharing our cards. We had a wonderful mailing station where they could actually pick a card and mail it out that very same moment. This boba tea card was one of our favorite one. And it's actually a blank card. You can do whatever you want with it, whatever message. But the feedback we heard constantly was like, this is so me and my friends. This is our thing. This is what we do. We don't do iced chai lattes. We don't do just regular coffee. We do boba. And so this is definitely one that has been a favorite among our consumers and our team as well.
Interestingly enough, this other card, which is in the Uplifted collection, that features a young little black girl with her natural hair and a crown on her head and a yellow dress, and her arms are crossed, and she's got a tinge of sass at that same conference. So remember, Asian American professionals, a young Asian woman walked up and was like, that's me. And we looked at each other and we're like, who's you? And she was pointing at this young girl. And it wasn't obviously because she's black, because the woman who looked at her was Asian American. Now, she may also have African American in her, don't know. But it was really, as we talked to her, it was the attitude and the sassiness of the little girl that she saw in herself. And so, whereas for some people, you look at this and say, well, this card is very specifically for African American consumer because it has an African American girl on it. People can see themselves themselves in lots of different ways, and they don't always take it literally.
Yeah.
And so for her, it was about the attitude and the sass. And I loved her comment with her just walking up like, there I am on a cart. And we're like looking around like, you're in the uplifted section.
But you know what is also funny about that? I never thought about that. You know, you see little girls on birthday cards or whatever, mm-hmm. and it's always, you know, well behaved. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Mm-hmm. Smile.
Mm-hmm. Pretty unconventional, right?
Yeah.
I would like to add that definitely several of these lines, particularly Love You Mucho and Uplifted, are really a direct response to the growing demand by women of color to see products that reflect themselves, that reflect who they really are, whether it's because they feel powerful and confident, multifaceted. I mean, the connections that they're really women are, you know, reclaiming definitions of what it means to connect with others, sisterhood, beauty, self-love.
Christy Moreno, Monique Haupt, thank you so much for joining us from Hallmark today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Up next on KCUR's Central Standard, the story of men and boys in ballet. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman, and as we look back on 2019, we're taking you to that time back in August when a host on Good Morning America made a careless and insensitive joke about the 6-year-old Prince George loving to dance. In New York, the men of the professional dance world protested in the street. Within a few days, the anchor apologized, and those protests turned into a spontaneous, joy-filled ballet lesson led by men. It inspired a larger conversation about the messages we send to boys about what they can and can't do. The men of the Kansas City Ballet joined that discussion. Their contribution was a proudly defiant photograph, which they shared on social media. Devin Carney is the artistic director for the Kansas City Ballet, and he joined me right as this was all happening to talk about the photo.
The photograph, it was a clear and immediate response once we had heard about it, and I pulled all the men together and said, we need to say something. And so we took that picture, and I wrote a thought-felt post, which went kind of viral, and I really am proud of our dancers, of the company, and of the school, all the boys in the school as well. But it was really just a statement of solidarity for what was going on in New York.
Beyond the comment itself on the air, when you say solidarity mm-hmm. in what kind of condition? And solidarity is usually like you're in a fight together.
Well, that's a good way to describe it, Gina. We are in an art form that is fairly underrepresented, you know, in the general consensus of the cultural mind of the country. And it's very important to stand together when one young boy is shamed in such a way at the very, very beginning of their possible career and their desire to be a dancer. And that's the solidarity, that it's okay to do that. And it's something that they should have the opportunity to do without feeling in some way that it's less than good or right.
We're also joined by Tyrone Aiken of Kansas City Friends of Alvin Ailey. Hi, Tyrone.
Good morning, Gina.
What was your just immediate reaction when you heard about the joke itself and the fallout from it?
My immediate reaction was one of surprise. I initially thought, well, this is being blown out of proportion. And then I had to step back and think that what is really insensitive about it is the challenges that it creates for young people, all young people, boys, girls, that want to dance. As Devin said, it is an art form that is not in the schools. So because it's not, in order to access it, you have to really be brave enough to want to try it, especially as a young boy.
To take the step yourself.
Yes. And so
to tell your parents.
To even face your peers. So there's still really challenges dealing with parents and young people that you interface with regularly. And so for me, it was the idea that there is an opportunity to really bring forth why it's important that boys are dancing, why it's important that men dance, why it's important that dance as an art form has something to tell us about our society and how we interact with each other.
Where do the two of you think that the shaming of men who dance comes from? And I'm curious whether you think it's gotten better since you were young.
I would say that it comes from an antiquated, stereotypical thought process that somehow men who dance are weak sissies, that it's not really a profession. You know, if you've been in the profession long enough, you are asked when you're found out that you're a dancer, they say, oh, well, what do you do for a living? So it's not even thought of as a real profession. And that's a very old, antiquated thought process. And I believe that's exactly where it comes from. I think, Tyrone, you might have a little bit more to say about that.
So for me, it is a little bit deeper than that. It really is about the idea of what men do versus what women do. So I see readily where young girls are put into dance as just a matter-of-fact way of their development. It is something that men are stared away from, or boys are stared away from at a young age. And there is a stereotype that goes with that that's sort of reinforced. And it reinforces this idea that whether it's dealing with, as Devin said, being effeminate or being gay, or all of those things play a role in how we then interpret who dance is for or who should be doing dance.
You know, it seems, as I think about this, that some of the things that are considered like not for boys are things that have to do with expression, whether it's an interest or a passion like dance, or just a normal human thing like crying. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. So there is this emotional connection to it. But what people don't understand is dance is very physical. It's very athletic. And it really is about the idea of using but not only the body, but also the mind in terms of that emotional connection. So I think when you look at it purely from an athletic standpoint, it's a great opportunity for young people to engage in expressing who they are.
You know, for a while now, people have been really embracing the idea that we need to empower girls to feel that they can do all of the things once reserved for boys. And that is still not a perfect, but people at least seem to get that it matters. And for some reason, we seem to be slower to embrace the idea that boys should feel empowered to do the things once reserved for girls.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think that there are many different professions out there that are, like Tyrone was saying as well, is that, you know, boys are steered away from, and girls are encouraged to do, right? A great example is, you know, Swan Lake, for instance. You see it in popular television over the decades, you know, mocking ballet dancers, especially if a guy gets in a row with a bunch of women. And that's not
like a comedic
scene
in a movie.
Exactly. So we're always the punchline. And that's not what the art form is all about. And, you know, as Tyrone said, it's about expressing the human condition in all its glorious forms. And there's sensitivity in that art form. And so...
And there's thought and physicality in
yes,
the art form.
Yes, there's power. There's athleticism. There's incredible prowess necessary to do what a male dancer does. And I really believe that it's a celebrated art form in many other countries.
And I do think that all of the discussion that we're having now about gender nonconforming, non-binary, all of those things are helping us address the issue around what task or what job or what should you look like or what clothing you should or shouldn't wear. All of those things are being challenged now. And I think that discussion is important, in particular for young people.
I want to bring a dance student into the conversation. His name is Drake Taylor. He's 16 years old. He lives in Kansas City, and he's one of seven boys in dance from across the country who will be featured in a documentary that's still in the works about this exact topic. Drake, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell me the story of how you got into dance.
I got into dance. My parents saw me dancing around the house and they thought, you know, why not give it a try? So they put me in dance classes.
How old were you?
I was 3. Yeah. And I loved it. And I've been in dance ever since. And I love it still as much today.
Are you able to articulate what you love about it? I know that's just a tall order for anyone who likes anything, but can you attempt it?
You know, when you love something, you really just know that you love it. But I love how physical it is. I love getting a good workout from it. But I also love being able to connect with audiences. And I love being able to make people feel emotions through my movement.
You know, I used to dance when I was your age, and something that I remember about it is that there was this process of using your like mental focus to do something that at first just seems like a body can't do that. A body can't turn and then stop on a dime with no outside force acting on it. But then when you try it again and try it again and try it again and think harder and work harder, eventually it happens one day and there's just this exhilaration. Is that something that you experience?
Yeah, I think that's also plays into the idea that people really don't know what happens behind the scenes of dance because we make it look so easy on stage. If we didn't make it look easy, we wouldn't be doing our jobs. And dance takes a lot of practice to get hard things, like you said.
How do you think that gender has shaped your experience in ballet, in the studio, in the classroom?
I think as a society, we have kind of a stigma about male dancers. So that means there are going to be less dancers because people don't necessarily think it's like normal to be a male dancer, which it completely is. So I think the more we educate ourselves about male dancers, the more male dancers there will be.
So they're just, your experience is partly just being, are there, how many other male dancers are in your dance class?
There's about one other.
Yeah. I mean, my memory of dance was that all through my training, there was one boy who moved through those classes with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how it is.
What is that like for you?
You know, it's different because in any other sport, there's usually a more equal number. The number of boys to girls in dance is extremely, like, crazy. But it's sometimes can be hard not knowing that you're being represented in your profession. So I think the more male dancers we can get and the more we can get rid of the stigma, the better the dance world will be, which has been a great outcome of this whole controversy, because I think it's really created a platform for male dancers to speak up and tell their stories and educate people.
How has it been to be a boy who does ballet outside the dance studio?
What do you mean by that?
At school, at family functions, just wherever you go, that this is... If you're doing ballet at 16, you are a very serious ballet student because what it takes mm-hmm. to be doing that at that level. So that just has to, I assume, be part of your identity.
Yeah. Being a male dancer is very much a lifestyle because... when people ask you, you know, what do? You can sometimes some people will kind of be judging and because they don't understand what it really is. And like how you said earlier, how people sometimes don't even think of it as a profession. Yeah.
Yeah. That it would be just a hobby.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That you've mentioned the stigma a few times, and in what way do you feel the stigma, and like what kinds of situations do you perceive it in?
I think a lot of times male dancers will be picked on or bullied, like in this controversy. And it, even though people may not pick on me or other male dancers, it's still there. So I think the more we can educate ourselves about males in dance, the more the stigma will go away.
Devin, you were just agreeing very enthusiastically. Can you explain what you were feeling just now listening to a younger man having experiences that you can relate to in this way?
Yeah. Thank you, Drake, for being open about that. I really appreciate that. And it does remind me of my high school years. And, you know, it's tough being a male dancer, especially a male ballet dancer for some reason, because... I hid it during my high school years.
You didn't tell people?
I lied through my teeth, like a lot.
That's amazing, though, because, I mean, like I was saying, by the time you're doing ballet in high school, correct me if I'm wrong, if this wasn't your experience, but that's hours and hours and mm-hmm. hours every week, because mm-hmm. you can't just show up and do ballet once a week. Your body would not do it.
Right. And so I was helping my mom grocery shop. I was... going to the dentist, and I can fill in the blank of the list of things I did after school. And, you know, it was tough, Drake, because there was one day where, you know, of course, I'm in the Nutcracker. You can't get away from that. People are going to come and see that, right? And some family came, and one of them was a classmate of mine and saw me in the show. And guess what? It came out in school. And it was a tough moment because everybody started bullying me and picking on me like crazy. But I will tell you this quick story, Drake, which was really quite exciting. And it really put an end to it. And I really, there was a good to the end of this. And that was a big football player was picking on me in the hallway, you know. And he says, "You can't, you're such a sissy," all this kind of stuff, right? I said, "Okay, well, wait. Step back. Can you do this?" And I jumped up, I went up in the air, turned around twice. We call that a double tour and layer. And he said, "Oh, I could do that. No problem." And he went around halfway, fell flat on his face into a locker. And from that point on, it was like the education had occurred that, oh, it's a lot harder than I thought it was.
We have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll continue our conversation from August about men and boys in ballet. It was poignant and important, and it says something about where we've been headed as a culture in 2019. I'm Gina Kaufman. There's more Central Standard to come, so don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're revisiting a conversation about men and boys in ballet. This discussion first aired right after a Good Morning America host made a crack about Prince George and his love of dance earlier in the year. Prince George, at the time, was a six-year-old boy. Let's get back to our guests, Tyrone Aiken of the KC Friends of Alvin Ailey, Devin Carney of the Kansas City Ballet, and 16-year-old ballet student Drake Taylor. Welcome back, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So our switchboards have lit up with people who want to join this discussion. I'd like to turn first to Ian in Overland Park. Hi, Ian.
Hi. So I've been a professional dancer for probably about 20 years, and I have a six-year-old son, and of course I've, you know, been teaching him pretty much since he was born how to turn and spot and things like that. And he was playing at school, came home when I picked him up the other day, and told him one of the other kids said he'd make a wonderful pole dancer because he was spinning around at the playground.
Just a kid spinning around.
Yeah, I was a little shocked that somebody would say that to him, and it made me worry because I've loved dancing my entire life, and I really want him to get into it. And then I also don't want to sort of, I guess, inflict that opportunity for him to be, you know, mercilessly teased, even at the age of six.
You know, Tyrone Aiken, your mouth is agape listening to this story.
Well, I understand what he's saying. I've worked with lots of young people, and they are always, in particular boys, dealing with the issue of masculinity and what it means to dance and be expressive and to be free and how peers can really infringe on that. And what we really need to be thinking about is not only how to support young people and being their own selves, but also teaching the adults that are in those spaces how to intervene and to support that expression as well. Because I think that really matters. And when those adults can step in and actually make that a lesson for everyone to learn from, it makes it a little bit easier for that person to feel that they can be successful at doing what they want to do.
Along those lines, Megan is calling us with a parenting question. Megan's calling from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Megan.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on the show. My question kind of echoes Ian's, but maybe on the other side. I am a mom of two young boys, a three-year-old and a 16-month-old, so they're pretty young still. I grew up as a tomboy and with sisters. We were very into sports, kind of, you know, Gina, you mentioned how we've encouraged that more among females, it seems like, and I love that because that was very much my identity growing up. And so I feel like there's this pressure and expectation as a mom who was a tomboy and then especially with two boys to encourage that. My three-year-old he just loves to dance and it's so fun because we can be goofy and silly and, you know, just explore some of that together. It's so fun. But I do wonder as he grows in the next few years here. I would love to enroll him in a dance class, but I'm a little clueless with how to go about doing that, or even as a mother, and my husband's very supportive too, but like as parents, what are some language things that we should either gravitate towards or steer away from? How do we go about finding a good class that will be inclusive, and some of those kinds of things? If any of the panelists can provide any insight, that would be very helpful.
Yeah, so the bigger question being, how does a parent support a young boy who clearly wants to go this direction?
I would say, you know, at three, he's just starting to find himself. That's pretty young, although Drake started at three, actually. Let's remember that. You know, you've discovered that he likes to dance, and I think that's fantastic. And so it's a matter of putting him in an environment that gives him the opportunity to first look at that as an idea, as a more sort of organized event, and have him go watch a class. It doesn't have to be necessarily a ballet class or a modern class, but just any sort of movement class where he can get a chance to sort of see if he's attracted to it. Obviously, you know, just because you start dancing doesn't mean you have to stay with that exact same discipline, but he can look around, I guess I could say. You know, he needs to experiment with what might speak to him. And that's the most important thing I can say here, is that you want to find something that will speak to him, that will give him the freedom to be able to express himself.
Yeah.
I'd like to tell parents that at 3, 4, 5, 6, it should be fun. They should find a place that they like. They should find a place that's open that will allow them to observe. They should find a place where that child feels happy. And this should be something that is joyous, that is play-oriented, and allowing them to explore movement. As they get older, if they continue, it will get more sort of codified and more serious and structured. But at that age, it should really be about the fun and enjoyment of just doing an activity.
I mean, Drake, I think you are clearly in actually the best position to advise here.
Yeah, I think starting at any job, profession, sport, et cetera, at a young age is always a good idea, because you can kind of feel around and see, you know, what your child wants. I think with me, it was very obvious. I was always happy coming home from dance. So I think just go for it, try it. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But just start looking for studios and try dance.
Well, I want to bring in another voice here. We'll get back to our callers, but Matthew Powell is with us. He's artistic director of Ballet Nova in Washington. He danced in the Kansas City Ballet from 2001 to 2008. And Matthew, what are you hearing in this conversation from afar?
For me, I'm hearing that we need more accessibility in the community. We need to work on outreach, because Drake, you're talking a lot about education, and I think that's fantastic. But I think I grew up in a small town in West Virginia, and we didn't have the opportunity to see male ballet dancers. I was pretty much the only boy in my class. And so I think if we can really work to kind of spread our message far and wide out there, we're going to be able to bring more people in, because you can see things on, you know, Good Morning America, you can see things on YouTube, but there's nothing like experience it firsthand for yourself. And so I really think that kind of getting out there and working on education outreach is pretty critical for this.
Are you heartened by the conversation that has emerged from this kind of controversy, or do you think that ultimately just the fact that it happened at all is demoralizing?
I am completely inspired by the dance community and what they've done to come together, and I'm completely happy at the outcome. I like the way in which it was presented. It was presented with love and passion, which is what I feel dance is all about. And so, like I said, I think it was a really good moment for the dance community on the whole.
Well, thank you so much, Matthew. I am sorry to not have longer to spend with you, but thank you for joining this conversation. Matthew is Artistic Director of Ballet Nova Conservatory of Dance in Washington, D.C. I'm going to go now to another one of our callers, Jacob in Lenexa. Jacob, hello.
Hi. So I actually graduated from a music theater conservatory in New York City, and I remember, like, just hearing what was said on Good Morning America kind of I was really taken aback because it wasn't something I expected to hear like today. As a younger dancer and performer, I see, like, my dance classes in my school had about the same amount of guys as they had girls, and to me it didn't really strike me anymore as, like, a conversation we were having. You know, I was just really, really surprised. Maybe it's just something that the younger generations have accepted, but I was really surprised to hear that we're still gendering things like this. Like, I guess to me it was just one of those.
I mean, we gender Legos. There are, like, pink ones for girls.
Seriously. And I just think it was kind of, I mean, I know a lot of people thought it was dumb, but I guess I didn't understand why we were still having this conversation after, you know, after we had the whole women's rights movement, and now we're, like, in the middle of completely redefining what gender is, and people are becoming more open and acceptable to different terms. I just think that it was really surprising.
Jacob, you know, I hate to tell you really something. Everyone in this studio is shaking their head right now.
Yeah, for me, a big part of why we're having this conversation and why there's a long way to go is that dance is one of those art forms that's not readily accessible. It's not in the schools. It's not like music. It's not like art. So there's not the opportunity for all of the teachers, all of the parents, all of the students, boys and girls, to experience this art form and to see what it's really about. And so, as Matthew talked about, accessibility is key to changing some of these ideas that we need to really be talking about.
I think it's going to start in school. I think the more that we can get, I mean, school is a place where all kids are at. So I think if the education can start there, then they'll become interested, and more boys will become interested in dancing and go to studios, and just there'll be more avenues for people to get interested in dance.
You know, so many of our questions, Drake, have been about what adults can do to support boys who may be experiencing mocking, teasing, even outright bullying. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if there has ever been an adult who you see as like a model for the grown-ups out there who want to support boys in pursuing whatever interests they have, even if they're outside the sort of, like, box. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I think any parents of a male dancer could be that model because they support their kids, even though some people really still don't get it. And
just by driving them to the lessons or whatever.
Yes, that's so important.
That?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that, Devin?
I agree. I think that it starts with your parents, of course. I think that there are some great role models in our industry that are great to look to when a boy is feeling the pressure outside the studios. There are some great role models out there. You can find many of them online, of course. And, you know, there's also that fact that it's a road that's not easy. And I think that's something that as a parent, you have to help your child understand is that, you know, you're choosing something that's unique. It's beautiful. It's different, you know, but, you know, eventually there's going to come that point where someone's going to say, that's not really an acceptable thing for me, they might say. So to really be prepared for that, I think that's also something to educate someone in as well.
For me, it really was my German teacher. German club is where I started dancing, German folk dancing. But when I discovered ballet, many of my teachers said, no, don't do it. It's a dead end. And this one role model said, you can do anything you want. If that's what your passion is, go for it. And she is still in my life today. That's over 40 years ago.
There's a lot of controversy around telling kids they can do whatever they want, be whatever they want.
That's true. But that is something that I think is so vital to finding what we kind of search for in terms of either happiness, contentment. You talk about work or talk about career or talk about what's going to fuel you. And so I think it's really important to have that idea of finding something that you can be passionate about and wake up excited to do every day.
And to learn to own it no matter what anyone else says.
And I would say one last thing, and that is remember words matter to a child. And everything you say to a child who's interested in pursuing this beautiful art form, make sure it's positive and encouraging, because just like his German teacher, made a huge difference in him. That, you know, saying something negative to a child at that moment could make a complete life change for them. So be careful with what you say and always encourage children to do what they love to do.
We've got to go now, but I really appreciate all of you for joining this discussion. Tyrone Aiken of the Kansas City Friends of Albanese, thank you.
Thank you.
Devin Carney of the Kansas City Ballet, thank you.
Thank you, Gina.
And 16-year-old ballet student Drake Taylor, to be featured in a documentary called Why Dance, thank you and good luck.
Thank you so much.
You just heard a couple of episodes of KCUR's Central Standard from earlier in the year. They stuck with us, and we thought they captured something really important about the state of our city, the way our conversations about race and gender have been headed throughout 2019. We'll keep listening to some of our best shows up through the new year, and we hope you're enjoying them. You can talk to us about any of what you're hearing on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, and we always love talking with our listeners. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Mackenzie Martin and Noah Taborda. We had help on the Hallmark segment from Aviva Okeson-Haberman. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date.